Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 6, delivered on September 6, 2018. The title of this lecture is Analysis of Financial Statements.
Today, the analysis of financial statements. This is a continuation, of course, of the last lecture. I'm going to go through some of the important aspects of generating pro forma financial statements from existing financial statements, and I'll actually do one of your homework problems with you here in class, because sometimes those are, it's obvious what you're doing, and sometimes it kind of, it's one of those things that can flummox you. Well, what do I do at this point? How do I solve this part? So I will do one of those in a while, one of your homework problems. It might benefit you. You know you won't get a zero on the assignment that way. But before we do that, of course, it's always nice to have a look at the markets. And today is going to be an interesting day. Right now, the markets are politely ignoring the politics in Washington, which is getting probably one of the weirdest times in my life. Are going on now, but that's not really affecting the markets yet. However, the markets are still edgy and nervous right now, and you'll see that as time goes on. But let me turn on the overhead projector. There was no terrible economic news last night on any front that would be particularly important to the market. So in a typical day like that, overnight, the market is going to have its tendency to be biased upward. And of course, as you see here, it's nothing spectacular, but there's a broad-based rally. It's small in the overnight market. It's not anything that you can pinpoint. There's something big going on. The other part of this, of course, though, is that as you can see, things like the Tesla is continuing to drop. And that's just because Tesla sucks. It's going to have to make some kind of a decision soon about its leader. Is he going to let go? Does he have the ability to let go of a company and allow it to grow again? Or is he going to hold on because of his ego and his belief that he's the only one who can be that company? But very quickly, let me draw over to here. And again, I don't have my bookmarks on these computers, so I have to get my own stuff. Treasury yield curve again. Keeping an eye on what's going on, we're going to have a quick look at what's the yield curve. Well, really, I wanted to do the current month. There. As you can see, that spread between the 7 and 10 year is holding at 5 basis points. It's not going anywhere. Now, if you were to look a little bit more closely at the yield curve, what its behavior has been recently, you would say, okay, I want to do the dynamic yield curve. And I've got that, by the way, the link to this is on my podcasting site, isu-prof.com, so that you can see the dynamic yield curve for yourself and keep an eye on it. It's worth it for you to watch it. Quit it. Get off me. Go. There's our yield curve right now. That is a sickly yield curve. It's not healthy. It's ill. It is lying very flat. It should have a nice, healthy upward arch, not too high because that's an inflationary thing, but certainly this flatness is a sign that the economy is not feeling well. But of course, until you see that yield notch, that yield go above that one, we don't have the inversion, and therefore we can't call a recession coming up. However, if you want to watch this yield curve, this was about 6 months ago, notice a couple of things. The first thing that you notice, tell me, talk to me. What do you see? What do you see? What happened there? In that first part where the yield curve began, I'm going to do it again so you can see it, and then you tell me. From here, what were you seeing? You're being awfully untechnical here. Can you give me a little bit more accurate? Let me do it again for you. This is analytics. This is that part that machines can't really do as well as humans can. We can look at these things and we can see the behavior. Watch the yield curve. That was the yield curve about 6 months ago. Now watch what's happening. The first thing that was happening, look up here. See this part right here? What was going on? What's slightly lower? That's okay. That's okay. It takes a while to get this. You can see it, but you don't have the technical language right now. And so that's why I do this. And I try to humiliate some people when I do it. So watch this. What's happening? You see these yields on these intermediate term treasury securities. You see those yields right there? Look at those. There, there, and there. Watch how those yields begin to fall downward. The yields on the intermediates, the 5, 7, and 10, and even the 20 to a certain extent, but certainly not as much, are falling. That means that that would be a yield, for example, on a 7-year would go from 2.86 to 2.71 or something like that. The yield on a 10-year would go from 2.95 to 2.82. They're slowly falling. Those intermediate term yields are dropping downward. They're sagging inward. Then the next, again, watch. Look, see those intermediates. Look at these, the 5, 7, and 10. Watch how those yields are sliding downward. Lower yields on those, which would mean that prices on those are higher. So there's buying in the intermediate. You're seeing movement of capital into the 5, 7, and 10-year debt instruments. There's money going in. That's pushing the prices up, which is pushing the yields down. Now, the next thing that happens, watch this part. In the last couple of months, look at those yields beginning to push upward. Then you've got the 10, 20, and 30. Those yields are rising. As those yields would be rising because the prices are falling, and the prices would be falling because there is either more supply of those or there is less demand for them. Now, this is probably the result of supply conditions. Why would the prices of long-term government debt instruments rise? Let's try that one. And this one's a tough one. Can you give me any guess? Why would, say, a 30-year treasury bond, its price is falling? Why would that happen? Why would the price fall? And give me an answer that is a supply answer.
Because there's not much demand for it.
Okay, try the supply side on it. Prices fall when supply goes good. Why would the supply of long-term treasuries be going up?
Because there's not that much of it.
No, supply is going up.
Okay, when
there's more of it. Okay, now we're almost there. You got one more. Why is there more supply of 30 and 20-year treasury securities. Why would that be? This is a hard one. Huh? Yahtzee. The government is borrowing like a drunken sailor. The government is just pouring debt instruments. They're borrowing. They're putting these on the table saying, please buy these, investors of the world. We are desperate for money. We are spending so much. We've cut taxes so severely that we have got to borrow like there is no tomorrow. And we are borrowing on 20 and 30 year debt instruments. In other words, the Treasury Department of the United States is just laying out on this table, borrow them, buy this, which means lend me money, please. And they're putting more and more of this because we are borrowing money at such an insane rate now that we're essentially, we're just putting these on the table, please buy, please buy. And so the world's investors are just sitting there, yep, they've got a whole lot of that on the table, haven't they? Which, of course, drives the prices down and the yields right here. You see them. Look at these yields. See the yields on those long-term debt instruments of the government sliding upward because the price is falling because there is so much of it out there, paper that the government is selling into the open markets. Who buys? Now, let's try that one. Who buys? In other words, who lends our government money? Who lends our government money? In other words, who buys our treasury bill, our treasury bonds? Oh, well, yeah, anyone. Well, you couldn't. You don't have the money. Yeah, China. How does China? You see, to buy American treasuries, China would have to have American dollars. How did China get American dollars in the trillions and trillions of dollars? How did China do it? Where would they have got all of this foreign reserve of American dollars in the People's Bank of China that they could then come back here and lend us money by buying our treasury bonds? How did they get that money? Any guess? You're wearing it.
Clothes.
And everything else. When we buy Chinese goods, we are importing their goods and exporting our dollars. That is the current and capital account. We buy very, very nice clothes. Don't get me wrong. They're made in China, but they are quality. And so we buy their clothes, their toasters, their electronics, their mobile phones. All we buy those. They come here. We pay for them in American dollars, which go over there. Those dollars go to the People's Bank of China, and the manufacturers get the equivalent in their currency, the yuan. Can you say that? Yuan?
Yao.
No, not yao. Yao. No, yao.
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 Yeah. You're not ready for the global stage, my friend. I should talk. I went down to Panama. I was desperate. I had to learn Spanish so fast because I was starving. Yo quiero hamburguesas con queso. Doble. And they looked at me. No, gringo. You want a couple of double cheeseburgers? Just say so. I was so embarrassed. Anyway, okay. That's the two-way flow of capital. Okay? Now, we do the same thing. Of course, we buy Arab oil, so the Arabs have money of ours. So the only place they can spend an American dollar is in America. So they do it by buying our treasury. They do it by buying our corporate debt. They do it by buying our stock, our issues of stock. They do it by providing the money to banks for the loans, for your student loans. They do it by all of these means. We export dollars to these countries by importing their goods. It's just exactly a mirror reflection. It's just a mirror. And then once they have those in their foreign reserves, in their central banks, they then have to spend them here. How do they spend them here? By lending us the money so that we can live beyond our means and live in a low, low taxes, high, high expenditures environment, which is what we do. And that means that, of course, when we go getting tough on all these countries, well, Canada, which, by the way, we do the same with them. They've got nice American foreign reserves. China, Arabs, all you people, we're going to kick your asses. We're going to teach you a lesson with trade barriers. Oh, God. That's going to cause some severe problems because suddenly that flow of American dollars up to there, up to those countries, this isn't going to be there anymore. And so they won't have those dollars to buy our debt. And so the demand for, so in other words, as our supply of debt goes up, that will drive prices downward. And then as the demand for that debt goes down, because these countries won't have the money to buy our debt, they won't have American dollars, demand will go down, that will bring prices down, which will push yields up even further. So what's ultimately going to happen is that, see that ass end of that out there? That thing is just going to keep going up and up and up. Because as the prices go down, because our supply is going up and demand is going down, yields will push upward on the very long end of the yield curve. And that, of course, will create the economic slowdown. And so as this is going up, these will rise too, but you will see eventually this will come up above that one. We will have the inverted yield curve. Probably won't happen until November at this point, but it will happen. That is real economics, what you should have been taught before you came here, because now I have to show you this so that you understand the dynamics of interest rates for the work that we're going to be doing down the road here in the next couple of weeks. As we see how interest rates affect decision-making in firms, financial decision-making, how it affects the lives of firms, how it drives stock prices. Right now, again, we're just sitting in this wondering what we're going to do next. Let me get myself back here. Just looking at these, we're all good right now, but it's kind of hard to say where we're going to be in 6 months. Because as the supply of debt increases, our government has to borrow huge amounts of money. That in itself is going to drive yields up because prices will go down. But when you have the other side of that, and those providers of the American dollar, providers of money for these loans disappears, that's going to mean that the price, that's going to just cause the yields on those to go higher and higher. Essentially, the government will have to offer very high yields in order to attract capital. And whatever the government does as far as yields, corporations will have to do too to compete for those dollars in the foreign markets that are going to be disappearing. Mm-hmm. Say that again. Would they buy treasuries? Probably not. Well, I mean, the yields on treasuries still aren't as good. Besides, companies like Apple, corporations in the United States, they do have investment money that they put away, they buy long-term. That's usually things like insurance companies. Active operating companies generally tend to say, where can we get the most out of our investments? In other words, they would look at a treasury bond. They say, well, how much are we going to get in that? Yeah, it's safe, but I mean, what are we doing for our shareholders by buying this kind of stuff? It really doesn't make our company grow. It's not an investment in a new technology. It's not anything that really interests a company like them. There are companies, however, that do invest in treasury securities. Like I said, primarily insurance companies will do it. Very large trust funds tend to do it because of the safety of the instruments and the long-term nature of them. But more active living companies, they're more interested in using their investment dollars within their own company, for example, or by putting that money into new technologies in other companies by looking around, all right, this company is viable. Let's see if it's worth it to buy it. If it is, we're going to put our investment dollars there because our return on investment is going to be much higher than it would be if we put it into something safe like a treasury bill. Good question, though. Excellent. As a matter of fact, mutual funds tend, you'll see very safe low beta mutual funds tend to buy into treasuries fairly actively, just because those kinds of mutual funds are for very risk-averse investors. So you'll see in their list of investments lots of treasury stuff. One that's interesting I can show you right now. This is actually an ETF, but AGG. This is such a well-known, respected fund that, I mean, it's used as a benchmark for other other funds. The yields are actually used as benchmark yields. Now, this is this is an ETF. It's a mutual. It's like a mutual fund. Now, if you were to look at its portfolio, some of the big things in its portfolio. Notice, by the way, that even these that are at the top of its list have very small percentages. It's widely distributed. It's a huge, they go for, you know, like 50, 80 things at a time. So even the top ones have only about 1.5% in it. Fannie Mae, Ginny Mae, those are agency, government agency bonds, agency debt.
I was going to say gold. No, they're not going to that. See the treasuries.
Notice that almost everything they have is either direct government debt or a government agency debt. So there's a place you would see a lot of money flowing in to it. But at the same time, these funds don't have anywhere near enough. When the treasury lays out on the table, we need... at this auction, run an auction every couple of weeks. At this auction, we've got some treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds. We are going to sell those. That means we're borrowing money from the entities that buy them. Okay, we've got $50 billion right here on the table. That, in other words, we need to borrow $50 billion in a combination of maturities, 1 year or less, 2 to 7, 2 to 10, 10 to 30. I mean, when you got $50 billion in one shot, in one auction, and a couple of those maybe every month, oh, God, there's no way that even corporate America could cover that kind of nonsense. That's going to require those massive foreign reserves in the People's Bank of China, in Saudi Arabia's Crown Bank, in the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Japan, all these banks that used to be the central repositories that had a lot of American dollars that we had sent over there when we bought their stuff. It's going to start to dry up very quickly because of the tariffs and the fight that we have picked with these countries. Look, China's an asshole. No question about that. They cheat and trade. They've done it for years. But you see, you've got a choice. You're playing poker, sir. Now, there's someone at that table. He is 6'8". He weighs 300 pounds of pure beef muscle. He's a mixed martial arts expert. And he has just cheated on a hand at poker. Are you going to stand up to him and say, "How dare you? Go away from the table." No, see this nose of mine? You notice that it's crooked this way? Rule one of Fight Club, don't try to fix your own broken nose. Rule two, the next time you get your nose broken, don't think that you can fix your nose and get it right from the first break. See rule one. We're picking a fight with the wrong bad guy. But, you know, that's just me being a survivor. Okay, enough of this. Let me take you on a little bit of a journey here with some finance. Oh, I want to do this. SEC.gov. Well, let me check this. Before I do this, let me actually check to make sure that I'm going to look at a company that is profitable. Actually, I think Caterpillar was, but Caterpillar was a little bit, oh, well, I've got its financial statement, so I might as well do that. But just quickly going through a couple, Netflix, NFLX. Okay.
Yeah, that one's, yeah, it's profitable. Doesn't pay a dividend. EPS is $2.20 per share. So if I were to go over to the SEC.gov, and have a quick look at Netflix, NFLX, NFLX. And eventually I want you to get to the point where when you're, someone says something about do this company or do that company, you have these automatic, okay, I'm going to jump right to here. That'll be my launching pad for whatever I want to do. And SEC.gov, its EDGAR filings are one of those launching pads that we... AK. Oh, that was that thing last month. Okay. I was going to say, is there a new 8K out there? Looking at the interactive data very quickly on Netflix. Financial statements. Consolidated statement of operations. Okay, again, just going through the basics. See this operating income? One thing that oftentimes, that's the same as saying EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Don't ever forget that. They use different terms for the same stupid thing. We used to have a lot of discipline. You had to say, use this, these words for this line. Anymore, it could be EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, earnings from consolidated operation before interest, expenses, and tax obligations. I mean, they can call it about anything. But that's EBIT. Now, in here, one warning that I give you is that notice, again, depreciation is not broken out as a separate line. You're going to need it later in order to calculate free cash flow. But it's not being broken out as a separate line here. That's actually, unfortunately, kind of common. If I want to see what the depreciation is, I'm going to have to go over here to the statement of cash flows. There it is. See it? So you're going to need it. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that in order for me to get free cash flow, that would be revenue minus costs minus depreciation times 1 minus the marginal tax rate of the entity. That buys you earnings before interest and taxes. Now, this is unleveraged. You probably also want to say minus interest in here, too. When I say unleveraged, it's a company that doesn't borrow money. Unleveraged is just a fancy way of saying, madam, are you leveraged? You are?
Yeah.
You are. I am leveraged like you, like, I mean, it's, a, I mean, I'm on that end of the teeter-totter that's 5 miles out there. And Fat Albert's about to jump on the other side of it and toss me, okay? Yeah. So, and then breaking this out, add depreciation back in. Because the only reason we take depreciation out is because it actually shields some of our revenues from taxes. It isn't a real thing, but it creates a real effect on your taxes. Think about it this way. I'm going to show these a little later in the course, a couple of companies. Kellogg, and I can't remember the numbers very well, but a few years back, Kellogg decided that it was going to jump into the gluten-free market. Now, that was a risky move because a lot of companies are scared to death of putting gluten-free on the label of food. Because you know what gluten-free means? Tastes like Shiite. Seriously, I make gluten-free food for one of my relatives, and I don't eat it. And anyway, it's terrible. But Kellogg said, let's try to do it, and let's try to add flavor to it and all of this. So they went on a project to make a series of breakfast pastries that were gluten-free. Now, this was going to cost them, I think the cost of the project was going to be $15 million. Okay. $15 million. Now, you understand, though, that by the depreciation that was going to be realized through this upfront cost, they'd have to spread it over some years, obviously,
What they were going to do was, yeah, they had a loss of that $15 million, but every time they took away, let's say, like $2 million for depreciation for the year, that protected some of their revenue from tax exposure. So in other words, there is a tax shield parked in here with that depreciation that we have to appreciate, really makes projects not as expensive as you think they are, because part of that is tax deductible. And so we have to appreciate that tax protection. However, when I was showing you these financial statements, you don't have to worry about the minus depreciation in those parentheses up there, because somewhere in here, that depreciation was put in there, but you don't see it anymore. They used to break it out as a separate line. I'm curious, in your accounting classes, when they show you financial income statements, do they show a depreciation line separate from the other part of it? I think they still do, but interestingly, in practice, they don't even show it anymore. So all you really need to do for this top line here is take operating income, 838679. 838679. You following me on that? That's essentially. Now, if there were interest, I'd probably take this minus interest expense here too. Matter of fact, what I probably should do, in order to do this comprehensively, I'm going to rewrite this. I apologize. I'm going to do full leverage on this. Revenue minus costs minus depreciation minus interest expense. I'm going to do the whole thing, times 1 minus t. Notice that your interest expense is also tax deductible. So in other words, if I've got, let's say, I've got a 10% interest rate on my debt, my cost of debt capital is 10%. But if I'm in the 40% corporate marginal tax bracket, my real interest expense is only 6%. That's something that is a feature that encourages companies to take on debt, is that by subtracting that interest, you're actually creating a shield. Now, the other interesting part of that, think about the company that borrows money at, let's say, 10%. It's a huge corporation with a high marginal tax bracket, 40%. My little pissant company, my marginal tax bracket is 15%. We both borrow money at a pre-tax interest rate of 10%. The giant corporation's after-tax cost of interest is 6%, 10% times 1 minus 0.4. But my after-tax cost of interest is 8.5%, 10% times 1 minus 0.15. So our tax system punishes me for being small relative to a giant corporation. In other words, it encourages large amounts of debt in large corporations, and it actually doesn't do hardly anything for me in a small corporation, which is just the reality of it. The same is true of homeowners. You get to deduct your interest from your taxes on a home loan. If you're in a high tax bracket, that's a hell of a shield. But if you're in a low tax bracket, it means almost nothing to you. So in other words, borrowing money and having a nice house is much more advantageous to a rich person than it is to a working class poor person. It's just a feature of a progressive tax system. Anyway, let me write down the numbers here for Netflix, NFLX. And I'm going to get rid of that first one there, because I'm going to go full bore on this. Just do the real free cash flow. Might as well. Interest expense, income before income taxes. Right here. See right there? That's everything in that parenthesis up there. Do you see it? Do you see right there? That's everything in the parentheses. 485,321. 485,321. Now, I would minus out the taxes here. One minus, and Netflix. Here's another interesting thing. I really should get bookmarks. Okay. PG. Are they going to show it? There it is. Come on. I don't want to care about people. I care about companies. Sorry. That was inappropriate. Come on. I said corporate. Federal corporate tax rate. Corporate tax rate guide. Come on. All these ads. How? Tax rate. Tax foundation. And, of course, they're not going to tell us. Yeah. Let's try this. And there's, okay. There it is. There it is. Okay. Can you see that? Let me turn off these lights. Don't be creepy when I turn off these lights. Oh, really? There. Is there something you see that's kind of weird? Do you see it's a progressive tax system? The last dollar you make, the higher your income, the last dollar you make, the higher your tax is on that dollar. That's a classic progressive tax system, but there's something weird in there. Do you see the odd little thing in there? Ma'am, do you see it? Is it really a progressive tax system? What do you see?
So like the fourth line down, it goes from 39% to 34%.
Oh. Oh. And then it goes up to 38%, and then it goes back down to 35%. In other words, the higher you get in, once you get to a certain size within a class of companies, you get tax breaks. And then you go to the next tier, your taxes go up again until you get to be a mega company, and then suddenly your tax rate goes down again. That is political. And don't believe, well, there are all these complications we got to do. No, it's political. The companies at the largest of different sizes in different tiers of companies are going to be the most active as lobbyists in Washington. So once you get to a certain size, well, they're going to give you some nice benefits so that you give them money. And then when you get to the mega huge corporations, well, by God, we see reasons why we have to give you a lower tax bracket than we do the companies that are smaller than yours in the same tier class. You see it? Look. 15, 25, 34, 39, oops, 34. There's those $10 million companies. They're very active in political action committees. And then we go up again, 35, 38, oops, there's the giant companies of the earth back down to 35%. And don't believe anything that this is technical and we have to do it because of this, that, or the other. No, no. And in fact, in reality, the vast majority of the largest corporations in the United States pay little or no tax, and I'll show you that, the staggering way that they can manipulate the tax system. But we're not going to do that. We're just going to say, okay, Netflix is probably about a 35% marginal tax bracket company. About 35%. Okay, so in other words, this line right here would be times 1 minus 0.35. Something like that. Now, I'll bet I'll probably be off because they're going to use all kinds of tax shields. Let's see what their taxes really would have been on calculator. Let me see something here. Let me look at Netflix. 485, 3, 2, 1. Times 0.35. Their taxes should have been a little south because of the lower tiers that some of them would have been taxed in, but a little south of 170. Now let's look at Netflix. Oh, there it is, not Netflix. Okay, good. Provision for taxes. 73,608. What did I calculate? You see the problem? Technically, they would be somewhere around 170. And what are they actually paying? Providing 73,606. Yes. 0.35 would be their taxes. I'm calculating their tax, how much their tax liability would be. Which, in this case, if I were to do it technically, I would do 48531 minus 0.35 times 48351, which would be 0.65. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to break out the taxes alone as 35% marginal tax bracket. You follow me on that? So just to say, just to show you, what we show you in theory is not what is going to happen in the reality of it. The theory would be that Netflix would pay 485321 times 0.35. It wouldn't quite be that because they'd be taxed at some of their income at lower tax brackets. But it should be around 170. The reality is that what they are providing is for 73. So in other words, the reality is that their taxes will be only less than half of what you would calculate them on a theoretical level as. But we're just going to pretend that we did this 0.65. And what we get there at the end should be net income. 558929. 558929. That's not the number that's not what would happen if I did 485321 times 0.65. But it's what actually happened. Now, we have got the first piece of free cash flow. In other words, free cash flow starts out with net income from the financial statements. It starts out there. And that's really where you start. I did this thing here, but it's really just net income from the financial statements. Now we have to do something to fix that depreciation, because depreciation doesn't exist. You don't write a check to depreciation. When I just spent $4,500 in my company, I'm allowed to take off about $900 a year. I didn't really write a check to depreciation for $900. I wrote a check to Amazon for $4,500. So the first thing I have to do is add back the depreciation expense because it did not happen. So in this case, taking this over here to the, where was that cash flow? There it is. Why did I see it so easily the first time? There, 71911. 71911. 71911. Add it back. Because it didn't happen. What really happened was I spent the whole shebang. So I have to look here at the statement of cash flows. A mother's work is never done. How much did I actually spend capital expenditures? So minus capital expenditures. Okay. Minus capital expenditure. Now, I could do this with a simple, you know, a plain, easy company like you see in your homework, but I decided, now I'm going to show you how we really do this. This is it. It's not really that hard. This is actually kind of the hardest part of it, is finding in this stupid statement of cash flows what their capital expenditures really were. How much did they really spend on things last year? Now, operating, don't look at the operating, because that would already have been up there in the financial, in the income statement. What we're looking for is, where the hell did they spend money on property and stuff like that? Okay, where did they actually spend money in here? Ah, do you see it? I didn't even mean to do that. There's a hint up there where it is. You see it? Again, where did they actually, you see it? I got the cursor sitting almost right in that area, yeah. Yeah, it's, okay. Acquisition of DVD content assets, really the stuff they've got sucks these days. Purchase of property and equipment, okay, other assets, purchases of short-term investments, proceeds from sales. Isn't that interesting? They spent a whole lot of money on property and DVDs, and purchases, but they claim that they sold stuff that was overwhelming. Okay, net cash provided by investing activities. Net cash provided by investing activities. So, okay, my color is meatloaf dense. They're claiming that they actually pulled in more money than they spent. So that's a little bit weird here. In their case, and I really didn't see this one coming, but that's okay. That's how I like to do things, just to show you how you bluff your way out when you're in real trouble, figure out what to do. In this case, they actually had a positive cash flow from spending money. They spent, do you see how, look, they spent, look at all this money they spent. See, that's cash flow out. That would be minus capital, minus. But then they sold this stuff that created inflow of capital, and by the end of it, they had a positive. So this would be, that's supposed to be a minus capital expenditures, but in this case, it would be a minus a negative. 34,329. Now that's weird. Let me find a normal company, real quick. Let me go back to SEC.gov. Is it hot in here, or am I just in a pig roast and I don't know it? If I had an apple in my mouth, I think I was at a luau. I'm going to take Cat here, just real quick. I want to see Cat. Financial statements. Where's their cash flow? Cash flow, come on. There. See, it's supposed to be a negative. See, that's what you're supposed to have, is a negative. Because you're spending money on new stuff. That's cash out. Netflix, apparently last year, what happened with Netflix was that they did spend a lot of money on stuff, but they sold stuff too at such a large amount of stuff that they actually had a net cash inflow from their investing activities. Now, typically, it'll be a net cash outflow. You know, you want to spend money on stuff. You don't want money coming in, you want money going out. Why don't you want money coming in? Why do you want money going out? Can you think of a reason why, sir? Why do you want money going out instead of money coming in?
If you have money going out, there's a lot of opportunities for different types
of money. Yahtzee. If you have money coming in, well, what happens with money coming in? You got to put it back out there. I mean, that's just it. You know, in the Army, you tossed a grenade out there. You want it to go boom. If it comes back to you, well, that's not a good thing. You know, that was yours. Okay, you got it, yeah. I mean, you want money going out because that means that you're investing, you're creating opportunities for yourself. So Netflix, actually, that's not a good sign when you got money flowing back in from investing activities. You want the money going out there to generate cash. Anyway, okay, so in this case, you got a weird ass thing, and that's the technical term, weird ass. Okay, but there's Netflix. Okay, we've got the capital expenditures. There's only one thing left that we need to deal with, and that is that we have to subtract the change in net working capital. Net working capital, NWC, is current assets minus current liabilities. The change in net working capital is, excuse me, oh, that was breakfast back. Denny sucks the second time. Excuse me. Shut up. I'm not feeling well. Grand slam really slams a second time. Okay, it's the increase. Think about it this way. If I have my inventory go up this year over last year, that's cash going out. That hurts me. My net working capital has gone up. If my receivables go up, that means that's money that didn't happen, that I wanted to happen, but it didn't. Here's something that really annoys me. I sell stuff on credit, right? That's an increase in receivables. It looks like my revenue went up, but it doesn't. But I'm still pay taxes on that stuff that I didn't get the money for. So in other words, what we're doing with the change in net working capital is we're recognizing the fact that when current assets expand, that's a bleed of cash flow. When current liabilities expand, that helps my cash flow. You work for me, and I decide I don't want to pay you, you're sad, but I've got more money in the bank for myself. Okay, that was insensitive to the workers of the world who should unite against us. Okay. So in this case, let's look at the balance sheet. Am I still on Netflix here? This is Netflix. Let me look at the balance sheet. Consolidated statement. Can't they just say balance sheet? Is it that hard? There it is. Okay, so current assets. Is that about? No, that's there. I was going to say that doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, current assets minus current liabilities for the current for right now for this year. Current assets are what? 7669 947 974, right? Minus current liabilities, which are 5466 5466 312. So the net working capital for the current is 2203 662. Now last year's, I'm actually kind of interested in seeing what happened here. Let me pull this over a little bit. Current assets, 5720 5720 291, minus the current liabilities last year, 4586 4586 657 657, 1133 634. Look at that. That is a big increase in net working capital over 1 year. What is that? That's like over $1 billion increase in net working capital. That is a bleed on free cash flow. In this case, what does that come out to be? I should have saved that other number. Minus the 220. I'll have to do the negative of this. 3662. 3662 equals pos neg on that. That increase, the delta, was $1,070,028,000. Wow. So in this case, we've got minus 1,070,028. Now we can calculate free cash flow. That was too much like work. Okay, let's do 5582 89 plus 71 911 plus minus a minus plus 34329 minus 1070028. This is not going to come out pretty. Ouch! That's $405 million negative on the free cash flow. That is not good. Oh, but wait. Wait. The income statement says that they made a profit. This is the problem with looking at the net income. It does not look at what matters. You could be a very wealthy person. Your net income is great, but you're bleeding free cash flow. That's the sign of a company that's in danger. Now, you can have negative free cash flow, and for a young company, it's going to happen. My free cash flow, quite honestly, I'm 8 years in on my company, and my free cash flow, I've got positive net income. I've got a profit, but my free cash flow is negative. And at this point, yeah, I could, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I'm a young company, I'm good. When I've got negative free cash flow and I'm at year eight, there's a problem. I've got to get past this, and that's not happening. And in a company like this, Netflix, yeah, it's still young and it's still growing. And okay, we'll let you have a few more years of negative free cash flow, but we're going to start setting limits. And that's what's going to happen with the boys on Wall Street. They're going to say, all right, Netflix, we're letting this go. We understand. You're growing. You got negative free cash flow. But you're going to get this under control within the next 2, 4, 5 years. That's how we do it with the companies, even with my own company. I have to be honest with myself. Grow up. Start getting positive free cash flow. If you can't do that, close the damn business down. Of course, Netflix isn't going to do that. They're going to try to keep going as long as they can and being very irresponsible. Look at what's going on. Here's one of the big things. Right here. Look at that. Look at all that money that they're putting into cash. Cash doesn't earn you anything. They're just amassing giant piles of money and putting it under the mattress. That's a bleed on free cash flow. That's what's killing their free cash flow. They're putting all of this money in where it's doing them no good. Where did that money come from? Well, there's where it came from. Look at their long-term debt. They grew $3 billion in long-term debt, and more than a billion and a, almost a billion and a half of that, they just put under the mattress. So they're paying for money, and they're not getting anything out of it. That's just the reality of it. Now, there's a couple of last metrics here I want to bring up to you. First of all, first things first, free cash flow. That's what we care about. We forecast pro forma financial statements. We just go out, growth rate of revenues, typical ratio for the different numbers in the income statement and the balance sheet, and then we just forecast free cash flows like that. We would just run that for, let's say, 5 years, 10 years. Then we find the present value of those and see what the company's worth. That's how you calculate the value of a company. You forecast the free cash flows out, then you bring them back to say, what are they worth now? There's the value of the company. The company also, we can look at the value of the company another way. We can talk about the free total enterprise value. Now, be careful, because the textbook has a couple of valuation little formula that are different from this one. I'll bring those up in a minute. But this is our pretty much our tool. If you're going to be in finance in any way or shape or form, you need to know the total enterprise value, which is the market value of the equity plus the debt. These are market values. These are not book values. These are market values. This one's your market cap. This one, you see, and we'll get to this in just a week or so, actually 2 weeks, the company will sell its bonds. In other words, it borrows money at the coupon rate. But the coupon rate is what the market thinks it should pay at the time the money was borrowed. As time goes on, the market's assessment of what it should pay will change somewhat or dramatically. Like, for example, you, sir, I'm a bond buyer. You sold me a bond with a coupon of 8%. That was fair at the time. That seemed reasonable based upon the risk. But however, your company has been doing poorly lately. The risk of it is higher. So the market now informs me and everyone, the next time you borrow money, you should borrow it at 8.29%. So in other words, we have to look at what the market says, what is called the yield on it. Now, okay, that would be the yield to maturity on the debt times 1 minus the tax rate. Because remember, debt is interest on debt is tax deductible. Remember, you could, look. You could really, if the company is really solid, the yield to maturity is going to be approximately the same as the coupon. So we could just, a lot of analysts, and I'm sloppy about this too, a lot of times we'll just sort of take whatever amount of debt is on the balance sheet. We just take that. And yeah, we should adjust it for the market changing its assessment of the company, but we really don't do that too often. A lot of times we'll just say, screw it. We're just going to look at what the debt number is on the balance sheet. But this market value of equity, you've seen that thing can really deviate a lot. So in other words, this is total enterprise value. Now, there are two other metrics, and I'm honestly not sure. One of them, okay, I've shown you a version of this. It was called market to book. You take the market value of the equity divided by the book value of the equity, market to book. The book, your textbook gives you one that's a little bit different, and it's called the market value of the company, the MV of the company, the market value of the assets, market value. Now, that one is actually market value minus book value. It's essentially the difference of them. I usually use the one that's the ratio, market to book. The textbook shows you the one where you take the market value, the market cap, minus what you see on the book. So, in other words, with... oh, God. Okay, with this company, what was Netflix, NFLX? 151.877, 151.877, minus, now we go back over here, and we look at the book value of the equity, consolidated state, book value, stockholders' equity, total stock, 3581 minus 3581 956. What? Did I do that wrong? Oh, I see. Yeah, I was just wanting to see, make sure you saw me do that. 151.877. Okay. 151.877. God, it's a good thing no one hires me as a consultant anymore. Minus 358 minus, really, 3.581. 3.581. There it is. And there's one more, too. It's kind of a weird one. There's another one where you take EBIT times 1 minus the tax rate. You do that, and then you simply minus the total capital investment times the after-tax cost of capital. So in other words, if you had a company, let's say that the company, this piece right here, if you had total capital investment of, let's say, $2 billion, and your cost of capital is 10%, and your marginal tax bracket is 40%, that's how you get that piece right there. You just take the total capital investment from the cash flow statement, and you would times that by the after-tax cost of capital. In other words, on average, what does this company pay for money it gets? That's about it. Go home.